It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Lots to cover. Not a lot of local, but I mean, as if there could be any room for local coverage with all.
Yeah, we had three snowflakes, and that took up 5 days worth of local media coverage. So.
But luckily,
there was a wisp of wind this morning. Maybe we ought to go up on the roof and report it.
We'll send you up in about 30 minutes.
There you go.
So luckily, the end of the week, you had announced the we've announced for several weeks now the FCC hearing that happened in Seattle. How'd that go?
Well, quite a few people, including maybe a few listeners of this program, turned out for that FCC hearing on Thursday night at the Central Library. This, of course, was a rerun of the public hearing that the FCC held, at least two of the Democratic commissioners out of the five total commissioners held in 2003 at the UW Hub Ballroom. Because the FCC was then considering a rulemaking proposal that would further deregulate media ownership by allowing cross-ownership between newspapers and radio or TV stations. That proposal was passed by the Republican majority on the FCC over the objections of about 3 million public commenters, Americans, that also commented to Congress and put a lot of heat on Congress. And so Congress was threatening to revisit that decision when a federal appeals court overturned it and sent it back to the FCC and said, you got to do all this over again. So guess what? Surprise, the three Republican majority commissioners are trying to do it all over again. So once again, we had the same public hearing, and we had it in Seattle on the anniversary of N30 of WTO. And about, somewhere between 400 and 500 people, I think, turned out, pretty much packed the auditorium in the Central Library. And big surprise, almost all of the speakers were vehemently against further media deregulation. Oddly enough, the two most compelling speakers of the night, I thought, were not from the progressive standpoint at all. They were John Carlson, who made basically a conservative argument for media regulation, at least when it applies to broadcast radio and TV stations. And then Mark Emmert, the UW president, neither of those gentlemen are people that I necessarily agree with on a lot of issues, but he made the case as an educator of why you need people who can synthesize information and think critically and why that doesn't happen when there's a media monopoly going on. So, but a lot of public speakers also gave testimony. I was several dozen. And it was a very, very good event, I thought. I was a little bit dismayed that more of the speakers weren't thinking strategically about how to not just impress the FCC that a lot of citizens care about this issue, because that's the biggest thing that's changed between 2003 and today is the media democracy movement that was a very new thing then is not at all new now, and we know that a lot of people care about this. What we need to start doing is winning these battles so that a lot of these arguments, particularly in things like public hearings, need to be couched in terms, and this is something I think Carlson understood, that would potentially appeal to one of the three Republican commissioners that was not present, because the testimony still goes in the public record. That being said, an awful lot of passion, an awful lot of people showing up on a cold and slushy night, and it was very encouraging to see that kind of turnout.
Very good. All right, well, let's move on to national.
And thank you, by the way, to the folks who did turn out, who listened to this program.
Yes, thank you. Court rulings nationally. There's been some this week.
Yeah, there were quite a few, actually, a couple of which were pretty good ones. U.S. District of Columbia District Court judge, a guy named Richard Leon, came up with a ruling this week that said that FEMA and the Bush administration had unconstitutionally denied aid to Katrina victims, and he called the whole process by which hurricane victims were asked to get aid in the Gulf Coast states that were affected by the hurricane as Kafkaesque, and he's absolutely right on that. But there was one priceless quote in his ruling that said he used the term Kafkaesque and factionally it was an imperative: free evacuees from the Kafkaesque application procedures that they have had to endure. So it's a kind of a call to arms from a federal district court judge, which you don't hear very often. And another district court judge, this time in Los Angeles, federal judge, a woman named Audrey Collins, struck down the Bush administration's or rather George Bush's specific authority under an executive order issued shortly after 9/11 to essentially unilaterally put organizations on a terrorist watch list. There have been hundreds of organizations around the world that have been identified by the Bush administration as being terrorist organizations, and it's not clear what the criteria are, how you get on the list, how you might get off the list, just very random and arbitrary. A couple of groups that were affiliated, I believe one of them was affiliated with the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, sued under this and won because basically it was just the unilateral authority of one man, President George Bush, and the court said that that, in fact, was unconstitutional. Unfortunately, there was also a court ruling that did not go well this week, and that was at the U.S. Supreme Court level, where rulings often don't go well, thanks to the Democrats having ruled over on Samuel Alito and John Roberts. I'm just never going to forget that. In this case, it was a ruling in which the government was backed in a bid to try and review New York Times reporters' telephone records, which is something they've probably been doing for the last 5 years pretty routinely anyway through the NSA. But they wanted to review the telephone records to try and find the source of a government leak. This in regards to a 2001 story on the government trying to freeze the assets of a couple of Islamic charity groups. Again, this part of a general administration campaign to try and crack down on journalists as a way of enforcing government secrecy and trying to go after whistleblowers in the government. So not at all a good precedent set by the U.S. Supreme Court in that case.
All right. And moving along, we always hear about the ratings and ratings games when it comes to television, and it sounds like they're having a little ratings game when it comes to those of us that fly on planes.
Yeah, sort of an unsavory revelation this week. Without notifying the public, federal officials for the last 4 years have been rating international travelers from all countries, including the United States, as to their potential to be terrorists or criminals. This, even though there's absolutely no evidence that any of these particular travelers might pose any kind of a risk or anything. And again, we don't know what the criteria are. We don't know if the ratings go up if they're Muslim or have brown skin or have funny sounding names. We just have no idea what the criteria are. So I wanted to propose that we start rating public officials the same sort of way. They're computer generated ratings, by the way. So there are clear criteria. But so we could have computer generated ratings as well. We could rate elected officials for their potential to commit war crimes or crimes against humanity. We could potentially rate them, for example, for their potential for being closeted gay meth users. There are any number of things we could rate them for. So, if you have your suggestions, email them on into the program, and maybe we'll roll them out in subsequent weeks when we have some slow news weeks and need to be entertained.
But my understanding of that, the original story is there's like millions of people on.
Millions and millions of people that were affected by, that were rated under this system.
And we, citizens, you don't have access to any of this information.
You don't have access to any of it. Anybody who's traveled overseas in the last 4 years has probably been rated. So that probably includes quite a few people who are listening out there. It certainly includes me. It's just a very, very scary Orwellian kind of thing. I think it needs to be kind of thrown right back at them.
And I would assume that this is tied into the no-fly lists as well. The two have to be synchronized somehow.
That wasn't part of what was publicized this week, but you would certainly think so, because those no-fly lists are presumably based upon some sort of a threat assessment, and this sounds very much like a threat assessment.
All right. Well, sort of connected to that, the you had mentioned, I think it was last week, maybe it was the week before,
the
Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act.
Yeah, this is a grotesque bill that's been winding its way through Congress that would basically criminalize as terrorism virtually anything where a citizen protests an enterprise that uses animals in it. This being part of the whole, eco-terrorism and ALF type scares. So that if you wanted to commit civil disobedience, if you wanted to blockade somebody's door, if you, you know, it could be completely nonviolent means of protest. It could be even be something as simple as a boycott, because you could, if you urge something that cuts into the profits or causes economic damage to the organization, it's very, very vaguely worded, and almost certainly won't stand up in court for that reason. But we're going to find out, because the Senate passed it and George Bush signed it into law. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is now officially the law of the land. Very, very frightening stuff. And it also raises the question, which I didn't think of last time we talked about this, but, you know, since human beings are animals, doesn't it criminalize this sort of act as terrorism, this criminalize this sort of activity for any enterprise? Because, you know, we are all, after all, animals, aren't we?
That's true. So that kind of expands the number of people affected.
Yes, to, like, all of us. Yeah.
All right. Well, moving along to international, a lot, as it is every week, a lot happening in Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we should just start calling it This Week in Armageddon, or, you know, End Times Digest or something, since that seems to be the motivation of some of the people in D.C. these days. A lot going on this week. Of course, Prime Minister Maliki pulling out of the three-way meeting with King Abdullah of Jordan and George Bush in Amman on Wednesday. He did that the same day that a report came out of a leaked memo from National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley that called Maliki basically either ignorant of what's going on in Iraq, unable to stop anything that's going on in Iraq, or complicit in some of the civil war acts. And we kind of know which those are in ascending order of probability there. But it did certainly add fuel to the speculation that the United States and or the leaders of the insurgency or some combination thereof have been hatching some sort of a plot to overthrow the Iraqi government. That government became even less stable because the 30 members of parliament who are loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr followed through on their threat on Wednesday to go ahead and pull out of parliament in protest of Maliki's meeting with George Bush, because he did meet with Bush privately for breakfast on Thursday morning. That leaves the parliament in something of a limbo. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia got into the act this week. They said that if the United States withdraws from or significantly draws down its troop level in Iraq, they would seriously consider intervening on the side of the Sunnis there. The House of Saud, of course, being Sunni, and Saudi Arabia being majority Sunni. It's by far the most powerful Arab military power in the region. The concern about that, of course, is that when you have Iran sending money and weapons and supplies to the Shiite insurgents, and Saudi Arabia doing the same for the Sunni insurgency or sending in troops of their own, what you wind up with is a proxy war on the battlefield of Iraq between the two largest oil producers in the world. Yuck. So there's that going on. You also have the Iraq Study Group coming out with its report next Wednesday, in which it is expected that it will recommend some sort of a drawdown of troops. Now, they're not going to recommend that troops leave Iraq or leave the bases or leave the Green Zone. In fact, there will be a minimum of 70,000 troops that will be in Iraq under the Iraq Study Group's expected proposals. They're also expected to propose that the U.S. start talking with Iran and with Syria. And you know, that's basically what will be said. And bear in mind that James Baker and the other people who have been part of this, Lee Hamilton and Robert Gates, who's now going in as Department of Defense Secretary, he started answering questions from senators this week, and they were cream puff questions by and large. You know, these folks are not the font of all wisdom. They're the folks who abandoned Afghanistan in the first place and gave us al-Qaeda, for example, in the late 80s. They're the folks who were responsible for Iran-Contra and yada, yada, yada. There was a report this week that Robert Gates actually urged that the U.S. bomb Nicaragua in 1984. These folks are not the font of all wisdom, but they're going to be received that way in the establishment media this week. Meanwhile, completely absent from the establishment media this week is a fascinating little, or maybe not so little, scandal that's unfolding down in Australia. What does Australia have to do with this week in Iraq, you might ask? Well, it has to do specifically with the Australian Wheat Board. Okay. okay, what does the Australian Wheat Board have to do with Iraq or anything else for that matter? Well, it turns out that the Australian Wheat Board, which is this, you know, trade organization that promotes the export of Australian wheat, was under investigation for selling wheat on the black market to Saddam Hussein during the economic sanctions prior to 2003. And as such, they deposed the minutes of the board of directors of the Australian Wheat Board. And sure enough, it turns out that the chairman of the board of the Australian Wheat Board is a good friend, or was a good friend, with the then ambassador of Australia to the United Nations, who in turn was close to the Bush administration, the Prime Minister of Australia, John Howard, being very conservative and one of the few international players that's backed up George Bush on his foreign policy. So, what we have is the chairman of the Australian Wheat Board telling his other members, and this being faithfully recorded in the minutes, that according to the Australian ambassador to the United Nations, he had been told by the Bush administration that the Bush administration had firm plans to invade Iraq, and that in the case of the Wheat Board, that they should, you know, sort of manipulate their wheat sales accordingly. So, you know, you have folks getting rich off the advanced knowledge of an invasion of Iraq, which is one problem. But the other problem is that this statement was made in February of 2002, months before the Downing Street memos, indicating once again that the Bush administration, probably pretty much from the moment of 9/11, if not the moment of the Bush administration's first inauguration in 2001, had firm plans to invade Iraq. This is the by far the earliest known recording of essentially somebody saying on the record that the Bush administration plans to invade, and yet it has gotten no attention in the United States. It's a huge scandal in Australia, but it has gotten no attention in U.S. media whatsoever. So that's why we're talking about the Australian Wheat Board. Meanwhile, a number of interesting statements that have come out this week and reports. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reporting that 1.6 million people have been displaced within Iraq because of the war there, and another 1.8 million people have fled the country. So 3.4 million people, and it didn't say when this is effective by, because, you know, it could have been this summer and it could have been more since then. But a minimum of 3.4 million people in Iraq out of a population of about 25 to 27 million in the country as a whole have fled the country or have been displaced within the country because of the war. A really, really frightening statistic. Meanwhile, you had also the Center for Strategic and International Studies coming out with a report this week saying that the Department of Defense is still cooking intelligence around Iraq. It's not talking about weapons of mass destruction anymore. Now what it's talking about is the readiness to fight of the Iraqi army, that we keep hearing that the Iraqi army is ready to stand up so that we can stand down, and meanwhile they're pretty much falling down on the job. And finally, we had Stuart Brown, who's the Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. That office recently restored by Congress after it was cut in retaliation by the Republican Congress in retaliation for, you know, telling the truth about Reconstruction. Mr. Brown came out with a statement this week that in Iraq, corruption is as big a problem as the insurgency is, that is costing $4 billion, B as in billion dollars per year, and that one third of all U.S. funds that have gone toward Reconstruction are now under investigation, which is a remarkable statistic that U.S. taxpayers as well as Iraqi have been badly, badly ripped off by this war, in addition to all the destruction and mayhem that's gone on.
All right. And as well as there was a development with Anbar province?
Oh, yes. I actually left that out. That the U.S. Army and generals therein saying this past week that they are seriously considering entirely withdrawing from Anbar province. That's the province in western Iraq that is essentially controlled by the Sunni insurgency and has been for several months now, where the U.S. can really do nothing except go in, bomb civilian and insurgent targets, and withdraw again while it's being shot at. And it's not entirely clear what they're doing out there other than getting shot at. So they're talking about just giving up entirely in that part of Iraq.
All right. Well, let's move on to Lebanon.
Yeah, a huge demonstration yesterday in Beirut, and it will be an ongoing demonstration now. Hundreds of thousands of people crowding the central square in a Hezbollah-called demonstration. This in the wake of the assassination last week of Pierre Gemayel by an anti-Syrian politician in Lebanon. This week, the forces loyal to Syria, or at least that are allied with Syria, the Hezbollah and their allies, flexing their muscles, trying to specifically to overthrow the pro-Western government in Beirut. So you had hundreds of thousands of people rallying yesterday, and then thousands of those folks are staying in the Central Plaza in Beirut and are saying they plan to camp there indefinitely until the government is overthrown. So a tense situation in Beirut. You had King Abdullah of Jordan going on this week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday and saying that there are up to three civil wars that could break out in the Middle East in 2007, that not only Iraq but also Lebanon and Palestine. Some good news in Palestine this week is that Israel and Palestine agreed to a ceasefire. We'll see how long that lasts, but it is held for most of this week so far. You also had a couple of other interesting Middle East statements this week. One from Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, a moderate Republican who's been pretty much a critic of the war from the get-go. He came out and went quite a bit farther than most Democrats have actually gone in Congress so far, with an op-ed in the Washington Post on Sunday and in subsequent statements, saying not only that should the U.S. withdraw from Iraq immediately, but the U.S. should fundamentally rethink its foreign policy approach, especially in the Middle East. That is something we desperately need to hear from more of our elected officials. And finally, that profiling courage Colin Powell coming out this week, and not only saying that Iraq is a civil war now, which is, you know, kind of like stating the obvious, but also that he thinks the United States should not launch a military strike against Iran, and that he does not think that the Bush administration will launch a military strike against Iran. Hopefully he has some kind of inside information on that, or insight. It is worth noting that we were talking on this program earlier about the various carrier groups and whatnot that were deployed to the west coast of Iran and the Persian Gulf in October, during the run-up to the election, that those carrier groups and whatnot did not, in fact, provoke a war. They have, in fact, more or less stood down or stopped doing their provocative war games type exercises. So maybe as the U.S. quietly considers talking with Syria and Iran, which the Iraq study group is going to talk about next week, that they're trying to de-escalate that situation a little bit. That would be very welcome news.
All right. Moving along a little closer to home, Mexico.
Yeah, as you heard, if you listened to the John Ross interview at 7:30, the conservative president-elect Calderon was in fact inaugurated yesterday. It was done in a midnight ceremony broadcast live on Mexico TV. They then did an inauguration ceremony in Congress that lasted all of 4 minutes as the opposition leaders and party members tried to block the doors to Congress going in. There was a march of hundreds of thousands of people in Mexico City opposing the inauguration yesterday. You also had developments this week in Oaxaca State in southern Mexico, where the APPO, the People's Movement, the teachers' unions and whatnot that have been occupying various parts of Oaxaca City for the last 6 months now, there was basically a large protest the last weekend in which some 40 people were injured and about 150 demonstrators arrested. There was a burning of government buildings, and this week, during the week, a number of the leaders of the APPO have been disappeared. At least 20 of them so far have been either arrested or disappeared, and nobody knows where they are. And at the same time, a list surfaced that the government is targeting some 200 of those protest leaders, and another list surfaced with another 100 or so foreign nationals that are said to be helping out the movement down there. So a lot going on in Mexico this week.
All right, as well as in Ecuador.
Yeah, Latin America in general, in fact. Last Sunday, a week ago tomorrow, there was an election in Ecuador. So one of those OR places. Election in too many L's, election in Ecuador, in which a leftist was once again elected to a South American government. This being Rafael Correa, he was elected, even though in the original election, about a month ago, there were allegations of fraud, and the opposition party tried to steal the election. Tomorrow there will be an election in Venezuela, in which it is expected that Hugo Chavez will be reelected rather handily. So if you see a bunch of anti-Chavez articles in U.S. media this weekend, I noticed there was one in the New York Times on the front page today. Surprise, surprise. You will know why. It's because he will be democratically elected with a much larger majority than any American president has gotten recently.
And finally, briefly, KBR.
Yeah, Kellogg Brown Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, is in a little bit of trouble. They agreed this week as part of a plea agreement to refund to the government $8 million in overbilling that it charged for building a base in Kosovo in 1999 and 2000, this under the Clinton administration. So Halliburton's overbilling and fraudulent ways have been going back even before Iraq. But now we know where they got the idea.
All right, and since we have time, I'm going to squeeze this in real quick. A little note that someone sent me this week from FAS, the Federation of American Scientists. They put out a news bulletin on secrecy every month. And
do you have to be on a special list to get it?
Yeah, it's an email. Yeah, you're on a list.
It's encrypted, yeah.
Title being U.S. Research on Mind Control Techniques Cannot Be Performed on Human Subjects Without the Authorization of the Undersecretary of the Navy, according to a new Navy instruction. And this is from,
wait a minute. Do the actual subjects of the mind control experiments have to agree to this also?
I doubt it if they're in the Navy. According to Human Research Protection Program, Secretary of the Navy Instruction 3900.39D, issued November 6, 2006, Section 7A2, the Undersecretary of the Navy is the approval authority for research involving severe or unusual intrusions, either physical or psychological, on human subjects, such as consciousness-altering drugs or mind control techniques. That is a U.S. government document that just got updated.
Wasn't there the scandal at some point about LSD experiments in the 50s that sounds an awful lot like this?
I'm sure they've improved their techniques.
Yeah, it's now on a cell-by-cell basis, no doubt. Yeah,
yeah,
scary stuff.
Nano level. All right, events coming up.
Yeah, well, as we mentioned at 7:30, John Ross is in town. He's going to be reading at 2 o'clock tomorrow at Elliott Bay Books. Also 2 o'clock tomorrow, Indie Media, which sort of fell apart except for the sort of basic maintenance of a website as of a couple of years ago, is going to try and get resuscitated, and they're going to try and have more independent media in Seattle. If folks are interested in that, the meeting for it is at 2 o'clock at Douglas Truth Library at 23rd and Yesler.
All right. And then John Ross also speaking at Tuesday, 8 p.m. at the Wayward Cafe.
So yeah, that's up at the 85th and Greenwood.
Him and Jim Page.
Yes, and Jim Page will also be at Elliott Bay, I believe.
That's true. You are correct, sir. Talking, as we do every week, with Joff Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It is a volunteer community newspaper. We are in the midst of a fund drive because we need money to put this paper out. That's why we print it rather than just putting it on the web, which we also do. You can donate through the web, of course, by PayPal at www.eatthestate.org. You can do it through the mail, and there's information on this in the paper as well at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. Subscriptions make fine gifts for yourself or loved ones or friends or relatives or total strangers for the holidays. You know, we have T-shirts, yada, yada, yada. So anyway, support us because this kind of information is important to get out. And if you're interested, you can find the free publication anywhere you find free publications. You'll find Eat the State, we hope, at bookstores and cafes. King County Library System carries it, other places around town. You can also find the issues themselves on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if all of that or anything on this program just flew by way too fast for you to figure out what the heck I was saying, you can call our voicemail and ask. The number is area code 206-719-6947. And of course, we also happily accept volunteers because that's how we keep the paper going.